With the benefit of hindsight, I wish we had moved faster and asked a different set of questions. I'm deeply sorry that we did not.
That was George Barrett, chair of the Dublin, Ohio-based drug distributor Cardinal Health. And he was talking about the company's role in sending millions of addictive painkillers to small West Virginia pharmacies. But Barrett was one of five current and former drug company executives who testified before a House subcommittee on Capitol Hill on Tuesday about their role in the opioid crisis. Lawmakers accused executives of not doing enough to find and stop orders for the millions of opioids they say may have directly contributed to hundreds of recent deaths in the state. But the hearing wasn't full of apologies. Four out of five of the executives, including Barrett, were not willing to say their companies actually contributed to the opioid crisis. And there was plenty of finger-pointing at the DEA for not having better oversight. It all made Republican Congressman David McKinley of West Virginia pretty angry.
I just want you to feel shame about your roles, respectively, in all of this.
Tough words from Congressman McKinley there, who told the executives that they should pay for crimes that ravaged his state.
What's the punishment that fits this crime when 900 people in West Virginia lose their life or 115 people lose their lives across this country? Just a slap on the wrist? A financial penalty? Or should there be time spent for participating in this?
Well, on the ground in West Virginia, one public health expert says that going after the drug companies will only get us so far. Dr. Michael Brummage is an assistant dean at the West Virginia School of Public Health, and he's in Charleston now to give us a sense of the crisis. Dr. Brummage, did this testimony surprise you? What did you make of it?
No, the testimony did not surprise me in any way, since these companies are facing litigation from several communities around West Virginia and this part of the country to settle. So I don't think that their lack of admission to culpability is surprising in any way.
So, and for our listeners who are coming up to this story today, can you remind us of exactly what these companies are under fire for doing, what they're accused of doing as far as opioids are concerned?
Well, as you know, we have probably the worst public health crisis in America and West Virginia because of, in large part, the dumping of opioids into our state that were both prescribed by physicians who cared and also unscrupulous physicians. The pharmaceutical distribution companies were part of that large machine that helped pump these opioids into West Virginia. And when the pill mills were shut down and regulations began to restrict the prescribing of opioids, a lot of people then switched over to easy to obtain and cheaper illicit injection drugs like heroin and fentanyl.
And you mentioned pill mills and doctors. Are we just looking at the pharmaceutical companies, or do doctors themselves have any culpability in their role in prescribing these medications?
Well, there's a large complex machinery behind what ended up being as one of the worst public health problems ever to face the United States, starting in 2011 with the Institute of Medicine report on relieving pain in America, adoption of the pain as a fifth vital sign by the Joint Commission, medical provider reimbursement based on patient satisfaction, false advertising of potent opioids like OxyContin from Purdue Pharma as non-addicting. And then there was the prescribing of the physicians, the pharmaceutical distribution companies who began to ship out these large shipments of prescription opioids. And then we had and ended up with a society that's really addicted. And it's spreading not only in Appalachia, but it's spreading across the United States.
And the role of the drug distribution companies here, you see it as what?
Well, I think that they are one part in this larger machinery of systems failure. This is a large systems failure. And while they, I believe, have some culpability in the process, I think the context is important to see this. Just as we see in medicine, when we have a bad outcome, we want to blame an individual for the bad outcome. In this case, there is culpability in a sense of a larger systems failure.
Now, can you give us a sense of how this is playing out across the state? Obviously, the injecting of drugs is not limited to opioids, right? There are other issues that are connected to this. Tell us what that looks like.
Well, until recently, I had been the executive director and health officer for the Kanawha-Charleston Health Department, which had one of the largest syringe service programs in the United States. And we knew that several of our patients were not only injecting heroin and fentanyl, but also methamphetamine. So this is in the context of a larger prescription problem, but also illicit drug use from a lot of people. We know that almost 80% of our patients who were in the syringe service program at the time it was operational had transitioned from prescription opioids. Also, you know, we have one of the largest overdose rates in the country in West Virginia, and that was playing a large role in this as well, with people overdosing on fentanyl analogs and particularly carfentanil. A couple of years ago in Huntington, West Virginia, 26 people overdosed in a four-hour period. So that this is being played out in the background of a lot of other addictive issues here in West Virginia.
Dr. Brummage, what do we actually know about needle exchange programs? Tell us a little bit about what they are today.
Well, we know that the science is unambiguous about syringe service programs. The CDC has an information paper that shows that if you are part of a syringe service program, you're five times more likely to go into recovery, which is what we were experiencing in the health department. We had well over 100 people who had gone into recovery. We know that the return on investment is about 6 to 1 for HIV alone. In other words, for every dollar spent on syringe service, you save at least $6 on only HIV. We also know from the literature that it reduces actually the amount of syringes found in public spaces and the risk toward first responders. The most important thing for me, at least, about the program was treating people like human beings. A lot of these people who are using drugs right now are treated like modern-day lepers. Nobody wants to have them around. Nobody wants to see them. And this was a way to treat them with kindness and compassion in a way that we were gradually pushing them toward getting into recovery services.
What can we, outside of the individual, what can we as a society do, if anything, to sort of mitigate some of the issues that we're seeing with addiction?
I think that's an excellent question. I'm glad you asked it, because the answer for this is not going to come from a settlement. It's not going to come from Washington. It's not going to come from our state capitals. It's going to come when our communities can begin to work together, because the underlying fodder for this epidemic is disconnection, isolation, and fear. And we need to work together as communities and figure out ways with the resources we already have, but preferably with more resources from people like the drug distribution companies, from the federal government, to help us bring our communities back together and address this. You know, we often say it takes a village, which has been overused, I think, but in this case, it's really true.
I would have to agree. Dr. Michael Brummage, Assistant Dean for Public Health Practice and Service in the West Virginia University School of Public Health. Dr. Brummage, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.